Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin, as we do each week our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. And Layla, what's our next question, please?
We've got an email from Tom. Tom writes, "My wife is pre-diabetic and the doctor just put her on metformin. Her A1C is about 6.7.
Mm-hmm.
Tom,
wait a minute. Excuse
Tom,
me.
That's not pre-diabetic.
Say it.
It's diabetes.
Right.
At 6.4, it's diabetes. If her A1C is 6.7, that's definitely type 2 diabetes. Okay, so Tom continues. He says, "I was wondering what you thought about this drug. The doctor said it would make her pancreas more efficient because he was concerned that she might get kidney disease if he didn't put her on it. He said it would also help her to lose weight. Could you tell me how it works and what you think about metformin?"
Yeah.
That's a topic for a whole podcast.
Yeah, it's really interesting because metformin is one of the first diabetes medications that was well established when, in the dark ages, when I was a medical student. It was around. Okay, it gives you an idea, like, how long it's been around. It came under suspicion for a while, and it was withdrawn from the marketplace. And I believe it's one of the few instances of something that was withdrawn from the marketplace and then reintroduced. And the reason it was withdrawn from the marketplace is it was given sometimes to very sick patients with very severe diabetes, and it didn't work out well. They developed a condition called lactic acidosis, which is a dangerous condition. But they discovered, and this is, it's probably one of the most studied and used drugs in the world, with especially a lot of experience in Europe. It was discovered that actually it's quite safe unless you give it to some really very, very feeble or sick patient. So for ordinary patients with borderline blood sugar, it works pretty well. And actually, in a head-to-head comparison with all the new diabetes medications that have come along since metformin, and there are scores of them, and each time they try to come up with something better, you know, more effective, because metformin is somewhat weak. It doesn't really control diabetes all that well. Partially does. It's a mild medication. Mm-hmm. These medications have shown the ability to lower blood sugar and lower hemoglobin A1C. But in a toe-to-toe comparison with metformin, metformin was the only one that seems to extend life. And that's important because what's the good of lowering your blood sugar if you don't live longer? Really, that's the aim is to stave off death. So, I like metformin. Now, in addition, you know, I mentioned in part one, the research being done at Einstein on aging. At that self-same research project, they're now investigating the use of metformin, not for diabetes, but for life prolongation, because there's some pretty convincing studies that it seems to prolong life. Why does it prolong life? Well, maybe it works on insulin, which we know promotes inflammation and may, you know, increase the risk for cancer. There's also research on metformin for cancer. Say, a man who's had prostate cancer, you know, wants to know what to do. The prostate cancer seems to have gone away, but what do you do? What can you take? Metformin. Similarly, they're doing some research on other cancers. So, you know, I'm not against it. Here's the problem with metformin. It can cause gastrointestinal problems. So some people have diarrhea from it or urgency. But often
some people are tolerant of the – some people are more tolerant of the XL
The
time release version of metformin.
Right. Also referred to as glucophage. XL.
Glucophage.
Now,
the other thing while taking metformin is because it could deplete some of the B vitamins, you want to make sure you're taking an additional B complex or at least some B12 and folate.
Especially B12. Especially B12.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, because that wouldn't be any good because many older individuals already are B12 deficient and the metformin could make it worse unless they're taking an outside source of B12. And I noticed that in our patients who take metformin, giving them additional B12 really works. They never have B12 deficiency if they take a B12 supplement.
Mm-hmm. And so, I'll tell you, Dr. Hoffman, you already know this, but as a nutritionist, I don't like to see anybody on medication, but there are two medications I do like, metformin and low-dose naltrexone.
Okay.
Because the results, and low-dose naltrexone obviously for other reasons like autoimmunity or things of that nature, but metformin is terrific at doing what it's supposed to do. So, Tom, your wife's doctor, I'm very, very happy that she was prescribed metformin instead of some other diabetes drug, some other Johnny-come-lately that can't really compare. But her A1C is in the diabetes range, so metformin is indicated. But, Tom, your wife needs to be on a diabetes diet, which is a low-carb diet.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is type 2 diabetes, if this is what we're talking about, type 2 diabetes, she has a condition of carbohydrate intolerance. Therefore, you go on a very low-carb diet, and the diabetes can correct itself. That A1C will come down, and the metformin is only helpful.
Right.
And yes, it does somewhat
curb appetite, although you know, not that dramatically. Not that dramatic. Mm-hmm. It's just a little bit of an appetite-suppressing effect. But, you know, hey, I'll take whatever you can get. And where's this where does this individual come from? What part of the country?
Don't know.
Oh, okay.
Don't know.
Because I was going to say, he is...
coming for a consult.
He is in denial. You know, the Nile is a river in Egypt. It's also, I mean, the wife is, or maybe somebody is, because if you say this is pre-diabetes, hemoglobin A1C of 6.7, while not full-blown, poorly controlled diabetes, that's diabetes. That's diabetes. That's not pre-diabetes.
You just crossed the threshold into diabetes there, absolutely.
Right.
But the good news is it's reversible if you do the right thing, and the diet is the biggest part of that right thing. Metformin is helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Tom, what Tom was also saying is that, you know, the doctor said it would make her pancreas more efficient, and that he was concerned that she might get kidney disease if he didn't put her on it. A common risk of having type 2 diabetes is kidney disease and kidney failure.
Yes, exactly.
So it can help to prevent all that. But she's also got to do the diet. The metformin's not going to go all the way.
Right.
It is helpful, however.
Indeed.
Okay.
We're okay with
that. Tom, thank you for your email. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. We've got an email from Richard. Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. Based on your on-air advice that an EBT heart scan is a good way to judge artery health, a few years ago I got one, and I was very happy that my score was zero. Well, since then I moved to Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Since then I moved to Florida, and they really don't have it here. They have flash CT scan, spiral CT scan.
Right.
Are these devices acceptable? And since I had a zero score a few years ago, how many years should I wait before I get another scan?
That's a really good question. So let's talk about an EBT heart scan. An EBT heart scan is an electron beam tomography test, which actually is becoming harder to find because the technology used for it is dedicated technology. There's only one test you can do with an EBT scanner. So the places that now do check for coronary calcium, this is a test that looks at the arteries and it lights up when there's calcium in the walls of the arteries. And it gives you a score. It quantifies it, whether it goes from zero to several hundred or even several thousand. And it doesn't tell you whether you have blockage. It merely tells you quantitatively whether you have a little plaque, no plaque, a lot of plaque, but it doesn't tell you that you've got a blockage. So to find out if you have a blockage, you need either an angiogram or you need something called CTA, which is coronary angiography. And so, you know, I said that the machines that do this, you know, why would you do it on a machine that's an old machine that, you know, isn't used for anything else? You get less radiation with an EBT scan than you do with coronary angiography or with a CT scan. Now, virtually all hospitals have CT scans, and they're very happy to do this test. But and part of the reason is that EBT scanning is not covered by insurance. It's cheap. One of our places that we send people to offers it for, you know, sometimes under $200 or, you know, at most $300.
Mm-hmm.
So out of pocket, okay, that's not the worst thing in the world. But with a CAT scan, CAT scans are expensive, but they're covered by insurance. So most places will try to get you to do a CAT scan, and then they'll give you a coronary score. But you get more, a lot more radiation.
More radiation.
More radiation,
right?
Yeah. So that's why I like EBT scans more. You can get the same information from the CAT scan or from coronary angiography. In fact, coronary angiography is designed to also give you, amplify, it gives you information about flow. But who cares about flow if your score is zero? There's not going to be a problem anyway with flow. I mean, if you have a high score, maybe you want to know if the flow is diminished. But there are other ways to establish flow, like a stress test, or, you know, with thallium or... you know, if worse come to worse, an angiogram, which I discourage people from getting because that's often a pathway to getting a stent, sometimes unnecessarily. Now, as to how often should you do it, you know, some people say, well, you know, okay, in the old days it was like, I need my annual chest x-ray. Really? Do you? Well, no particular
every
reason
year,
to do.
Every year, chest x-ray.
Yeah, no. That why? It's actually been disproven.
Why?
And if you are... Even if you're high risk as a former smoker, you might say, I want to know if I'm getting cancer. It's still controversial as to whether an x-ray or even a more definitive test like a CAT scan can help prevent you from dying of lung cancer. So some of these, quote, routine tests, they're unnecessary and they don't make a difference. And if you have a zero score, and I just had this conversation with somebody, they had a zero score. I said, when should I do the test next? And I said, do it in 15 years. Because first of all, we're doing everything we can. You know, the person already is, you know, we're preaching to the choir. This person is exercising, following a really good diet. The only thing else that they could do is maybe go on a statin. Sometimes people with high cholesterol get pressure to go on a statin, even though they've had a recent zero score, and maybe we want to demonstrate to the doctor that there's still no problem. So even if the person advanced to a score of 3 or 8 or 12, that's still not, you know, associated with high risk for heart attack. So,
hasn't statin use for primary prevention already been debunked?
No.
Isn't a statin only good after a heart attack?
I have to be quite honest with you, is that, and, you know, because I look at the research and, you know, it's kind of like the people who watch the debates. You know, they watch the debates, and if they're for Trump, they think, oh, Trump killed it in that debate. And then you read, like, you know, other people said, oh, he blew it. You know, Hillary was just superb. And then, you know, people who are pro-Trump might say, well, Hillary made an idiot of herself. It's this, if we read scientific literature that way, you know, we're going to be biased. And there is scientific literature now out about statins that suggests that, and this has been controversial, that there is a primary prevention effect in people who have some risk factors. So now, there's two things. One is secondary prevention. You had a heart attack, you've had a stent, you have demonstrable, arteriosclerosis, you have angina. These are people who, you know, pretty likely will benefit from a statin. And, you know, as much as I hate statins, I think you got to go with the data. The data shows that there's some protective effect. I'm sorry, you know, for people who are anti-drug. So that's people already have a demonstrable heart disease. Now, the other thing is if you're okay, but you have a high cholesterol or maybe you're a little overweight or family history or something, the doctor wants to put you on a statin. They now have a new study, which is a big study, that shows that there is somewhat of a reduction in risk. The question is whether the application of a statin, which lowers your risk slightly, is worth it in view of the potential side effects, which are underestimated. And now, from the standpoint of conventional medicine, they minimize the side effects, they maximize the benefits. I tend to do the opposite. I say, well, the benefits, you know, according to some studies are real, but, you know, if you have 5 or 10 or up to 20% of people having subtle problems with statins, is it worth it? A severe or subtle problem. Sometimes the problems are very obvious. People just can't stand being on statins.
Yeah, they're completely statin intolerant. Even while taking CoQ10 or ubiquinol, they're still
Doesn't
having
help.
A problem.
Doesn't help.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I wonder about the risk factor of it causing diabetes. And I think this was found
20%, 20% higher in women. Yep. Yep.
Ah.
And it's not clear why.
Well, that's a problem too. Yeah.
It's not clear why. It may be, what's called moral licensing, which is that people who are on statins have a false sense of security. They can eat what they want. They don't need to exercise because they're protected. And then they get diabetes. That's part of it. Or it may be some intrinsic effect of the statin drug on insulin signaling that creates a higher risk for diabetes. And certainly, yeah, diabetes is a killer. So, you know, what it's a mm-hmm. major contributor to cardiovascular disease. So why go there?
I actually heard recently somebody say, well, you know, I had a little cake, so I took a little more Lipitor.
Oh, jeez.
There's your moral licensing.
There's a precise example of what's called moral licensing. Yep, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
I literally heard that. I said, what?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, Richard, thank you for your question. Best of luck to you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Time for
All
another
right.
question.
We've got an email from Caroline. Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. My daughter-in-law is 35 and has learned that she is losing bone in all quadrants of her mouth, some worse than others. Can you discuss the possible causes for this and any recommendations to reverse it, and whether including strontium is a good option?
Yeah.
Are there lifestyle improvements she could make? In addition, she eats a typical American diet and does not exercise. Mm-hmm. Thank you for all the interesting information.
Well, this is interesting
okay.
because this is, I mean, it's a subset of osteoporosis, but it often is related to local conditions in the mouth, you know, some sort of inflammatory condition.
Advanced periodontal disease?
Possibly. But there's also, even the osteoporosis medications can cause osteonecrosis of the jaw, which is a very profound form of bone loss. So I wonder if this person has had...
She's 35.
35, okay. Yeah,
she's 35.
Well, sometimes they start those medications early, but it's unlikely. You know, I do think that strontium could be beneficial. It's worth a try. Although I have to say, there are no studies of that specific proposition. I don't think there are studies looking at people with bone loss in their mouth, in taking strontium to see if the strontium will help to support that. On the other hand,
Dr. Hoffman.
Yeah.
I wonder, because she's 35 and they're noticing the bone loss in her mouth, her jaw.
Yeah.
I wonder if she's ever been tested for celiac disease.
You know, just as you were about to say that, I said, I bet she's going to talk about celiac disease. That would be really useful. And of course, to check vitamin D levels, for goodness sake, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But celiac disease is, you know, it's kind of one of those things that, you know, in a young woman who has unexplained bone loss, you really have to start thinking celiac disease, and that's so often missed because the person may not have digestive problems or may have minimal digestive problems, and it's not the first thing you think of.
Right.
Yeah, but it causes malabsorption.
Nobody sent her for a DEXA. You know, at 35, probably no one has sent her for mineral density.
They should.
But they should now, of course.
That's how we think. That's how we think. You know, when we're on the same page with that, and, you know, that's kind of the nice thing is our thought processes have sort of melded over the years, but, you know, it's kind of, you know, we ask the question, why? You know, whereas,
why? Why is that happening?
I'm not saying conventional doctors don't, but I think they're more oriented towards, look, who knows why people come in with all these god awful conditions. Let's find a drug treatment. I think it's important to investigate the underlying cause because that may yield a treatment approach. Not always, but, you know, if an arsonist burned your house down, you know, it's nice to find that out, but it doesn't restore your house immediately. But, you know, but it's useful to find the cause because maybe the next time you build a house, you may want to, you know, have a neighborhood watch, make sure the arsonist doesn't come and torch it, you know?
Right.
So, we're looking at an underlying causes. And, you know, so somebody comes in with heart disease, we'll go through any number of risk factors, you know, very comprehensive testing. Why did you get it in the first place? Or osteoporosis, you know, there are discernible causes for bone loss. So for example, we saw a woman relatively young, 49. We saw her together just a couple of weeks ago, and she, to her horror, has terrible osteoporosis. Okay, so, in fact, it was discovered because she broke her ankle or something, and they said, well, you know, broke your ankle, you know, maybe it's always a good idea to get a bone density if you break a bone. So they did, and to their astonishment, they found that she had the bone density of a 97-year-old, like really bad. So what could possibly be going on? She looks great. She looks really healthy.
Mm-hmm.
She eats a great diet. She has adequate vitamin D, on and on it goes. She's never taken steroids. But it turns out that she has for a long time taken thyroid medication, but not just any thyroid medication. She was taking natural thyroid medication very aggressively. She'd been, unfortunately, to some holistic doctors who were a little bit too quick on the trigger with the medication.
The thyroid medicine.
It made her feel better, but she was actually a little too jittery, but she, you know, she felt that was kind of like a natural Adderall, you know, like ADD medication.
Yeah.
It got her going, got her focused.
Go juice, right?
So, yeah, it was like, you know, like three Starbucks in the morning. But that probably caused her to lose a lot of calcium from her bones. Which it does. Hyperthyroidism or overdosing. So look, we're looking at underlying causes always.
Yeah.
So.
And you know what, Dr. Hoffman, something else occurs to me because she's 35. I wonder if she's on a PPI.
Of course. That, you know, she could have GERD.
That could be another reason.
Yeah, that's another cause for it. Sure. That's another. So we, you know, go through the causes. Right. So, you know, look, the reason we go through this, Layla and I, is we want you, our listeners, to begin thinking analytically and critically like we do. You know, a little critically about the medications and therapies that you're offered, not necessarily become a irrational refusenik, but, you know, ask the right questions, push back a little bit on over-medication or drastic intervention where it's not really merited. And number two, you know, start thinking causes, like, you know, why am I having this? And maybe undergo a little bit the kind of thought process that we undergo as clinicians when confronted with a health crisis, which will help you with your own, guiding your own self-care. And even if you require some coaching or some support from, a health practitioner, you know, whether integrative or conventional, at least you'll be a better consumer of all the options that are out there. Some of which are great, fantastic, and some of which I think are subpar, you know, both on the conventional side and the natural side, unfortunately, you know.
Yeah, and being a good consumer, being a critical thinker, you will only benefit from the type of solution that you choose.
Yeah. Wait a minute. I have a great idea for what to call this podcast. Hmm. We'll call it We'll call it Intelligent Medicine. How about that? Okay.
Look at that. Yeah.
Okay. Just call the trademark attorneys and we'll nail that down. Okay. All right. So comes to an end yet another episode of Intelligent Medicine. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla. Thanks, Layla, for a great session. And thank you, listeners, for sending
Dr.
your questions.
Hoffman. Yes.
And remember, send your questions to radioprogram@AOL.com. Check out our website for more content. There's lots more there, podcasts and articles. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter as well. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman.